May 1887. Louis le Prince had said his farewells to John and Joseph and Sarah Whitley and to London and the extraordinary American exhibition and had made his way across to Paris. It meant that, in less than a fortnight, he had arrived in England from New York, started hiring assistants for his camera, set engineers in various factories to work on parts for machines, visited his brother-in-law, taken in his brother-in-law's famous exhibition starring Buffalo Bill and his Wild West show, presented a bouquet of flowers to Queen Victoria, and then hot-footed it over to France. It was just as well that he got there as quickly as he did, for his mother was ill. It meant that his time in Paris was a combination of intense action and huge emotional contrast. On May the 18th, 1887, he wrote to Lizzie in New York, "Since my last, I have been absolutely in a turmoil, which began with John's American exhibition, the success of which is assured by the impression made by Buffalo Bill. The gardens are very well arranged, and the Switchback Railway, the Toboggan, and Dan Godfrey's band also have a great success. After the Prince of Wales's visit, and before the opening day, the Queen commanded a private view. Only the members of the committee and their families were present. John was presented with several other members of the committee. Then I led Dot forward to offer the bouquet to the Queen. She was accompanied by the Princess Louise, the Prince of Battenberg, and the Marquis of Lorne. I left the same night for Paris. Yesterday morning, I went with Mother to her garden on the top of Montmartre. It is less than our painting room, but it has more plants than our whole garden. It is precious for the health of the dear Mother. Between times, I am preparing parts of my apparatus that the facilities of Paris permit me to do, and thus make up for lost time. This afternoon, I will do Mr. Courier's errand, see Poilpot, then my machinists. Tomorrow, patent office and examiners, etc. The weather is rather cloudy and cool, but very fine for active work." Le Prince here says that he's making up for lost time. He certainly was able to continue filling his days with a frenzy of activity. We can see from the letter that he was due to see a Poilpot. I will guess that this was Théophile Poilpot, the director of the panoramas that Le Prince had worked on in the States. Le Prince would then go and see his machinists. This is a quick start on a device that was to be separate from the machines he had started work on in Leeds. For in Paris, he would build his 16-lens camera. The Shadow Traps, Episode 36, History at 10 to 32 a second. In Paris, Louis le Prince set up a second base of operations, employing carpenters and machinists to work on his 16-lens design. He also had the opportunity to be with his mother, who had become seriously ill. It was a month of intense activity and huge emotional contrast because of his mother's poor health. The story of Le Prince's time in Paris in 1887 consists of three main narrative strands, I feel. His mother's health, work on the actual physical 16-lens camera, and also work on his US patent for the 16-lens camera. Now, we've already covered the patent in some detail in its own right in previous episodes, but it's interesting to see what was happening with it in relation to Le Prince's life. Now, if you remember, April 1887 had seen his patent application pass only for Le Prince and or his lawyers to try and reinstate an earlier claim which brought a rejection from the Patent Office on May the 4th. Le Prince had arrived in England on May the 5th, and after a few days of frantic activity, travelled to Paris via London. So all these things were happening at the same time. Now, the response of Le Prince's lawyers to the Patent Office's rejection came on May the 24th, and, if you remember, this is where they seem to have complicated things by trying to add two new claims and writing a big explanation as to why Le Prince's design was different from Edouard Muybridge's. And it all felt like a step backwards and perhaps even a little bit of a mess. And this was happening while Le Prince was trying to get the camera built in Paris whilst nursing his sick mother. Le Prince found himself still in Paris at the end of May. He wrote to Lizzie on the 27th. I am still here, having found a mechanic and electrician who is fitting my lenses that I count on trying in a few days with a large plate, which will decide the practical possibility of my work. Now, this one sentence seems to be a really concise report on the state of Le Prince's progress. From it, we learn that the machine, built by H. Mackenstein, incidentally, of Rue de Carmes in Paris, is not yet ready, but should be in a few days. That Le Prince seems to have recently found assistants, one of whom was an electrician. Now, this is interesting, and it is slightly unexpected. To understand why an electrician has been brought on board, let's take another look at the design of the 16-lens camera. Now, we know how the camera works in very basic terms. There are multiple lenses with shutters, and the shutters go off one at a time, exposing onto two rolls of film inside the camera. But how did Le Prince get it so that the shutters went off one at a time? Well, an intricate series of cogs are being turned, and they are manoeuvring connecting rods and pinions and springs that are attached to the shutters. Now, if different cogs have different numbers of teeth, then each one's movement of their respective pinions and springs will be different from the others, and that means they'll effectively be staggered, and that in turn will stagger the triggering of the shutters. Incidentally, cogs with missing teeth to create intermittent movement like this are called mutilated gears. This is probably something all engineers know about and consider basic, but I came across it late, and it's one of those solutions to things that just feels so satisfying in its elegant simplicity. Anyway, mutilated gears play a big part in the story of film. Now, all these components, the gears and pinions and springs, were ultimately driven by a main motor shaft that could be cranked by hand, or, according to the patent description, might be powered in other ways, such as by weights and blocks, or springs in clockwork, compressed air or electricity, etc. However, I think that the chances are that in Paris it was hand-cranked. It would be the way Le Prince would power his later camera in Leeds, and it makes more sense in terms of filming outside on the streets of Paris. However, electricity did play a part in the camera that Le Prince had built in Paris in 1887. And we know because that camera survives. It is damaged and incomplete, yet remains beautifully odd and well made enough for us to still be able to see how it might have worked. And what is interesting is that triggering the shutters in this machine is a set of electrical contacts that would be set off in turn. This was not described in the patent description, and so this is a fascinating departure from the official design, which suggests that it was an attempt to advance the technology. However, there was another change to the patent design, which was not so much an advance as a stopgap measure. And this is alluded to in the sentence we've just quoted when Le Prince refers to a large plate. And this means a large sensitized plate made of glass put inside the camera to be the surface onto which images are exposed. The reference to a large plate seems to confirm the idea that the camera was a model rather than a completely finished machine, because the two rolls of film designed to be used in the camera were here replaced by this single piece of glass. This in turn suggests that Le Prince was testing parts of the camera and was resigned for the moment to the idea that the resulting images would be fixed on glass rather than rolls of flexible film. There are two significant points that come from this design change. The first is that the camera would not be able to film continuously because there would be no rolls of film winding on, allowing picture after picture. There could only be a sequence made up of 16 images, one for each lens, exposed onto a single large plate. Once each shutter had gone off, that was it. The plate of glass would be full. The second thing is that exposing onto a single glass plate meant that the sequence could not be projected back because there were only 16 images on a single inflexible material. The camera was clearly at an experimental stage at this point. The proof of working required by French patent law did not necessarily require a finished product, but a machine sufficiently advanced to demonstrate how it would and could eventually operate. This all seems to be confirmed by Le Prince's final comment about deciding the practical possibility of my work. Finally, the sentence we quoted contains the remark that he was still in Paris, which suggests that he had not expected to be, which could in part be down to the deteriorating health of his mother. Le Prince had a pied-à-terre on the first floor of his mother's property at No. 6 Rue Bouchard de Saron. It seems Le Prince, the dutiful son, had come back to Paris to look after her. It was another example, along with his journey to Paris to rescue his family from war in 1870, that seems to speak of someone with a strong sense of family loyalty. On the 28th of May, 1887, Madame Elizabeth Marie Antoinette Boulibert, Le Prince's mother, died at home at 6 Rue Bouchard de Saron. 2 days later, she was buried in Voulanges, the little town overlooking the Marne Valley that had held so many memories for the family. Shortly before her death, she had written to Lizzie. John, meaning John Whitley, has given me good news of you, for he has seen you last October, 1886. He knows about the photographic work and tells us that Augustine has had the idea ripening in his mind for the last 20 years. Let us hope he may not have worked in vain. In any case, it is no use to worry, for that helps nothing. If it is all tiring him too much, let him sell it and have other people do their share. Is there an acknowledgement in this letter of the possibility of failure? An awareness that the work has been taking its toll on Le Prince? That she would be happier seeing the work passed on than to have it wear down her son? Amidst the grief of bereavement, a letter from the United States Patent Office, dated June 4, 1887. Le Prince's two amendments had been examined and, as we've seen in previous episodes, his latest amendments were not completely successful, for while the Patent Office made no objection to the second claim, they rejected the first. On June 15, 1887, just over a fortnight after Madame Le Prince's death, Le Prince's lawyers submitted their response on behalf of their client. Erase Claim 1. We've talked about those who, retrospectively, assigned blame to Le Prince's patent lawyers for agreeing to erasing Claim 1 allegedly without Le Prince's knowledge, and apparently thus denying Le Prince of protection for a one-lens camera later on. And we set this in some kind of technical context where we suggested that this theory perhaps overstated things and wasn't really correct. But now we can add a layer of emotional context as well. Having been faced with another rejection from the Patent Office during a difficult time for him personally, would Le Prince have been in a position then to really sit down and come up with a new wording for his claims again? Perhaps Le Prince had got enough of the patent accepted and was unable emotionally to continue the fight. Perhaps, just this once, he ignored his perfectionist tendencies and allowed the claim to be surrendered. It's a possibility. Did Le Prince in this instance not dig his heels in part simply due to grief? We can't know for sure, but it is at least a possibility. In the summer of 1887, Lizzie and Adolphe, and possibly other members of the family, joined Louis in France, and while there with him, Lizzie witnessed the signing of contracts in June-July between the brothers Louis and Albert concerning their mother's inheritance, and which included the sale of Louis's half of the inherited property and furniture to Albert. It seems that a large part of this money went on the experiments in motion pictures. It also seems that Lizzie and Le Prince had such a strong sense that the project would ultimately be successful that it seemed to them to justify the investment of much of their finances into the work on motion pictures. This was something that had already been happening back in the States. For instance, Lizzie would write that every dollar we both earned over and above the bare cost of living sank into a kind of bottomless well for experimental work on many lines immediately connected with his invention. Some of those close to the Le Princes had thought them fools to be doing this, but Le Prince remained quietly dogged in his determination. Their inevitable success, Lizzie would explain, helped them justify, perhaps even to themselves, spending inheritance money on Le Prince's risky but heroic and potentially lucrative venture. This heroic venture bore some kind of fruit in the second half of 1887, because that is when Le Prince filmed in Paris with the 16-lens camera. Time-wise, a possible window for filming with a 16-lens camera was sometime in July to August in 1887. I say this because Le Prince didn't get to Paris until May and was apparently running around pulling the work and the workmen together. Lizzie was in Paris to see contracts signed June and July time, and she makes no mention of films having been made while she was there. She then left for New York, leaving Adolphe behind to aid his father. And in August, she is back in New York because Le Prince writes to her mentioning a sequence that he has done. More than mentioning it, sending her some of the images from it. Now, things might have happened earlier, but it feels that July-August 1887 possibly and vaguely is the when. As for the where, as you travel east along the Avenue Trudeau, you may turn left up towards Montmartre along the Rue Bouchard de Saron and past the Le Prince apartment, or, continuing along Trudeau for a few metres more, you might turn right down in the direction of the centre of Paris along the Rue Thiroux, where the workshop possibly was situated in which the model 16-lens camera was worked on. With his living quarters and workplace within a few hundred metres of each other, the area became a location for filming as well. It was here that Le Prince captured a series of images of one of his workmen. The sequence, which we'll discuss more next episode, does show movement, but not a great deal. There are 16 frames on the plate, although some have been broken and removed, two partially, one almost completely, and a couple of remaining frames appear too overexposed to view properly. The workman seems to have been walking around a corner on or near where the two roads Trudaine and Bouchard de Salon met. But even that is uncertain, and we'll talk location next episode. So many gaps in this vital chapter. Anyway, it does seem that the sequence was taken in this area, so Le Prince would have been filming not far from his mother's property. And this makes sense retrospectively, because we'll see in episodes to come that all the specific sequences that we know about were shot at locations near where the camera could be stored. And so, whatever the precise location, whatever the precise date, sometime in the latter part of 1887, Louis Le Prince filmed Paris with his 16-lens motion picture camera. Adolf would later write, "The 16-lens camera took them from 10 to 32 per second." Now, just a very quick observation here. Adolf says 10 to 32, meaning frames per second. That is, the speed at which the film was moving, or more accurately, how many images or frames were exposed per second. But he doesn't say the word frames, because no one did at that point. Film was so new, there were holes in the language. And this is a lovely aspect of looking at the history of film. Watching people work out how to do things, and then how to find the language to explain what they've done. Now, this particular sequence, the man walking around a corner, has generally failed to pass muster with film historians in terms of qualifying as a film for several reasons. For example, as referred to in Le Prince's letter, the camera was at an experimental stage, and so exposed all the images onto a single inflexible plate, which Le Prince would not have been able to project back. And at the time, the shutter seemed to have misfired, so that the images were slightly out of sequence. Nevertheless, it was an impressive demonstration of how far he had got. Adolf would state that as well as a sequence of a French worker walking was a series of life on the boulevards. Le Prince kept his wife informed of his progress. This included the news that he had indeed taken footage with his camera. Paris, August the 18th, 1887. I also enclose list and contents of parcels sent, and within you will find a set of 8 photos on gelatine film taken in about a quarter of a second, so I can take 32 photographs, and I may take more by revolving quicker per second of any moving object or objects. That is quite as many as required. The man photographed is my mechanic. He was running at the time. I have some better still, but I'm using them, and so send you this to show how far I have got. The good news was counterbalanced by more frustrations. For the second part, I find that I have been led astray by advisers and have to fall back on my original plan, i.e. one special light for each picture. The second part was an oblique reference, possibly oblique on purpose, given Le Prince's paranoia, to the projector. Whatever he had just tried as an alternative to 16 lights had not worked, and he was set, therefore, to return to his original approach, which in all likelihood had also failed if he had been looking for alternatives in the first place. And so we come across what was to become the bête noire of almost all the film pioneers, the difficulties of projection. Le Prince was facing an obstacle, but was facing it with determination. "I'll keep you posted as I go. I am getting nearer every day, and now shall not leave it till done." After this update, a request, not from Le Prince the inventor, but Le Prince the husband and father. Write me a few lines only, and the little ones with what they are doing. With love and kisses to you all. Ton Augustin, your Augustine. Now, if over the last few months you've been following me barefoot over the broken glass of my analysis of Le Prince's US patent, you will know that I lost track of a couple of the patent claims only to rediscover them towards the end. And something similar is happening here, I think, albeit within a single episode. And, as before, the oversight is instructive. I made an assumption about something, and on realising the assumption may have been incorrect, I learnt something new. This will have to wait until the next episode, except to say that the 16-lens camera was fitted with a glass plate. The camera, as it stands today, battered but beautiful, is missing its back part, which perhaps plays into the idea that it was an experimental model and didn't use the two rolls of film designed for it. An analysis of the surviving images of the workmen in Paris suggests that the sequences were shot on glass, for reasons I'll explain next episode. So there we have it, or so it seems. The Paris camera shot on glass and never progressed past that stage. Except, well, if you listened closely to the last letter I read out, you might find reason to doubt or be confused about that. Why? I'll try and explain next episode. Thank you for listening to this episode of The Shadow Traps. To find out more about the project or to support it in any way, please go to the Patreon page at www.patreon.com/theshadowtraps. Thank you very much for listening.